This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal, medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. I'm Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho, and here is where we talk with knowledgeable people about all things involved with struggling young people and the programs and resources that try to help them. Today, we're going to try to talk about how children and young people have faced life and overcome or dealt with the challenges in life. The guest is Lois Stern. Hi, good afternoon, Lois. Good to have you here.
Lon, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Okay, well, Lois has been an active educator, or was an active educator for about 20 years, and then got interested in writing, soon becoming the co-editor of a popular Long Island webzine. As she created and authored her column, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Lives, she solidified her special niche of investigative journalism and put those same talents to work while writing her first book about beauty, sex, lies, and cosmetic surgery. She followed up with her second book, Tick Tock, Stop the Clock, Getting Pretty on Your Lunch Hour, to address the less invasive path to beauty, but along with her interest in physical beauty, Lois tells me she has always been drawn to inner beauty stories, stories to touch the heart and soul. So the tales to inspire, and that's a trademark term, a kernel of an idea that Lois started in 2012, has grown to proportions she didn't dare to envision. She has now published three tales to inspire books, each named for a different gemstone, with the fourth one well underway. So now Lois wears many hats as author, presenter, publisher, and creator of Tales to Inspire Authors Helping Authors Project Contest. Okay, well, what is your Tales to Inspire project, Lois?
Okay, Lon, I call it both a project and a contest because it's both. One of my goals is really to help promote authors that maybe are less well-known or not known at all, and to help them embellish their writing skills. For an example, with this last book that's just in the works right now, The Ruby Collection, there were two stories that really had wonderful themes, but they just went off track and they needed editing. I do have two editors, and it's always the author's option. If they want to go further, they can contact one of those two editors and work with them. Both of those stories are now going to be published. So it's nice, and they rave about how that has helped them so much and helped their writing skills. So you can see the teacher in me coming out in the project part of this.
Well, after 20 years, it gets in your blood. I taught for several years, and yeah, I find myself getting into teacher mode. Two things. One, I forgot to mention that we do have, if you're listening to this live, we do have a chat function. It's in the general chat on the lower right-hand corner. So if you have questions, comments, please type them in or pass them on, and we'll try, Lois and I will try to get to them and answer them. And then, Lois, could you put your mouth a little closer to the mic? You're a little bit faint.
Sure.
I can understand.
How
you,
is but, this? Yeah. Is that better?
That's much better. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, good. You know, I could also maybe turn up the volume a little bit.
Let's see. Oh, you're doing fine now.
Okay,
yeah, I think you're
good.
Fine. You just speak up. That was much better. Well, where do these projects, contests, as you call it, where do they come from? Where's the ideas? What's the background of it?
Where did the idea of the contest come from?
Yeah.
Is that what you were asking? A few things. First of all, I was writing some of these inspiring stories, and I got the idea, gee, if I have a few of them, other people might have a few too, and we could put them together into just a wonderful collection. Little did I realize that I now have almost completed the fourth collection, the fourth book, and it's going strong. People are asking me, well, when is it starting again, and what will the themes be? So it's caught on, and I have to credit the Internet for that, because the powers of the Internet are phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Well, then another question. You published as a what's called an indie writer, that's independent. How has that helped you, and what's the difference? Because the standard way, if you have a book, you get an agent and market it to a publisher, and the publisher finally publishes it after all kinds of stuff, and then maybe you get a token a token royalty on it. That's the standard way. But things have really changed with ebooks and with independent publishing, and it sounds like that's a route you've gone. And so how has that helped you? Okay, a little bit of advice for people that might have a book in them.
Sure. Just to clarify a little bit, I started out with a traditional publisher. And I wasn't really totally pleased with the way it was going. And I spoke to them, and they were willing to break the contract. And I started all over. I started with different stories. I started with a different cover. What I love about this is when I get a story that I think, oh, this one would really work well in a book that's already published, I can add it. If I see a period there that doesn't belong, or a question mark that doesn't belong, or, God forbid, a misspelled word, I can fix it myself and re-upload to CreateSpace. And it's just, to me, CreateSpace is an incredible tool.
And, well, it gives you a lot more control on the whole thing.
That's right. That's right. And then you're not turning, not that I'm making much money on this, Lon, you don't, but when you have a publisher, you're giving them 60% of that net, at least,
or
they
more.
Get 100%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't mind doing the work. It's tedious. It is tedious, and you have to have a lot of patience for it. But I don't mind doing that.
Yeah. Well, I do that too. I have some books I'm going to combine into it, the Parent Empowerment Handbook, that relates to my business as an independent educational consultant. And so I've gone that route too. And I can agree with it. You give a lot more control, and the royalties are bigger if you for what sales you make. But you have to be a writer, editor, publisher, promoter,
and
right?
A marketer. Absolutely.
And a marketer.
Yeah. And, you know, as I've said before, most of us as writers, as new writers especially, we think when we've finished a book and gotten it published, we've done our deed. And little do we know, we're just beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That promoting is really the biggest job of all.
Yeah, it's really big. Okay, well, let's talk about the stories and a little bit of what the real content is. This has just been an introduction. But now, one of the titles, or one of the stories you wrote, is The Heart of the Home is Hot Chocolate. Now, this was by Mary Romero. We've had her as a guest a couple times. But what was that all about? The home is,
okay.
Or the heart,
well,
of the home is hot chocolate.
Sure. As you know, because Mary's been on your show a couple of times, and she's a wonderful guest, isn't she?
She is. She very good.
She sent in a story, and it didn't go into as much detail, certainly. Her topic and her vocation deals with domestic abuse. But the story that she wrote was about, first of all, some of the things that she observed in her home, and the fact that to the outside world, they looked like the perfect all-American family, dressed perfectly and well-mannered and all good things, you know. But on the inside, there was a lot going on there that was domestic abuse. And the hot chocolate part was that one of the wonderful memories that she did have of her childhood was when her father would say, anybody for ice skating, and the five children would get bundled up in their clothes and the father would make hot chocolate. And that was a very special memory for her that she carried into her adulthood with her own children. So that's basically what that story was about, and she wrote it very, very nicely.
Well, you know, that has become more of the whole thing of domestic abuse has become more in the headlines lately with that. Is it Ray Price? Is that the NFL football player?
That's right. That's right. There have been a few pretty horrible things, and a lot going on that gets covered up, too.
Oh, I'm sure. One of the things in following this, and this is becoming more of an issue over the years, domestic abuse, and trying to society's tried to do something about it, is sometimes people get the image that behind every facade of a family, there's abuse and horrible things going on. And I think that's a little exaggerated.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. I think it goes both ways, Lon. There's a lot going on that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And then there are children, too, who are calling the social services if their parent screams at them once and saying they're being abused and calling social services. So you're right. It goes both ways.
Yeah, finding that right balance is something we're having trouble. But I think it's good that they're talking about it, that society is talking about it, and it's come up again, and okay, we still need to do some things in order to protect the people in the family on that. Well, let's go on to the next story and tell me a little bit about this one. No such word as can't. What was the message that young people might be able to take from that?
Oh, what a beautiful message we have with this one, Lon. That you can do just about anything if you set your mind to it and you have the family behind you to encourage you. This was a story that actually my son told me about it, and it was a story that to me was so unbelievable. I had to find this young woman to talk to her. And lo and behold, I found her on Facebook, and I wrote to her and I told her what I was doing, that I thought her story was phenomenal, and I wondered if she would be willing to write it. Or if not, if she would let me interview her and I would write it. So she wrote back right away that she'd be happy to talk to me and let me write it. She's out in L.A., by the way. So the story goes like this. She was a beautiful little baby, Romanian heritage, given up for adoption sight unseen by the mother and father, the biological mother and father. One little detail. She was beautiful. She was adorable. She was born without legs. Fortunately, she was adopted by a family that just knew all the right things to do. They're the unsung heroes in this story. They already had three sons, but they adopted this little girl, and each of the boys had their own mission with this little baby. They loved her from the day one. One of them used to wear overalls with big pockets, and he'd put her in his big pocket and carry her around. One of them was in charge of picking her name, and he named her. Her name was Jennifer. And the third one was the athlete, and he taught her all kinds of sports. And the parents encouraged all of this. So this little baby without legs, as she grew up into a toddler, she climbed trees, she learned volleyball, she played baseball and crawled quickly around the bases. They grew up in a very small town, Midwestern town, and the neighborhoods, too, were helpful in making her feel a part of everything and accepting her. As she grew up, she became mesmerized by, this was way back when the Magnificent Seven were of the American Olympiads who won the gold. I don't remember what year that was. That goes back some time now. Mm-hmm. And she became mesmerized by Dominique Moceanu, who was the youngest member of the Magnificent Seven team from the United States.
Now, they were what, acrobatics or...?
They were acrobats, yes. Yes, okay. Acrobats. And she became her absolute idol. She followed every single thing about her. But it wasn't until the Magnificent Seven were up on that podium receiving their gold that Jennifer's parents were watching with her. And as Dominique was receiving her medal and they announced her name, the mother and father looked at each other. and they thought to themselves, this name sounds all too familiar. They went back to the adoption papers, and can you guess what?
What?
What? What? This was Jen's biological sister.
Mm.
Is that a story? But the beautiful thing about this story is that this young girl, because of the way she was raised, she said the word handicapped, she never heard the word handicapped. It just wasn't a word in their vocabulary. But they were always taught, okay, you want to do something? Let's do it. Let's find a way to do it. You have a problem? Let's sit down. Let's find a way to solve it. And this was the kind of encouragement that she grew up with, and she followed her dreams. She's very independent. She lives out in L.A. now. She travels all over the world. She's a world-class aerialist and a motivational speaker. Now, can you think of anybody who could be more motivating than she?
Well, you know, I think one thing you said in the material you sent me, that she was raised to believe she could do anything she set her mind to, a positive attitude. We were a lot of positive, and that's a lesson that somebody with even this, what we would consider a handicap, she wasn't trained to be a victim. She was trained to overcome it and just be the person she could be, whatever it took.
Right. And, of course, the fact that she was born that way makes a difference. So that was natural to her. It wasn't really a handicap. I'm sure there are things that make it difficult for her. For instance, every time we had a phone interview scheduled, I would call her. She wouldn't answer the phone. She'd call me back in a few minutes. So, and I imagined it was a logistic problem to get to the phone.
Mm-hmm.
She has that what she be. Called a retouché chair, a fancy word for a form of mobility for her. And she said, well, you know, I don't like to use it except when I'm going from place to place because it keeps my clothes clean.
Mm. Other than that, she just gets around on her own. And that's impressive. And it's an inspiration that any of these kids, it's a potential for any of these struggling teens or young people that I work with as an educational consultant and their parents, is that you can do it if you get rid of the mental blocks. And obviously she had no mental, emotional blocks.
Right, that's right. When she said to me, I never knew the word handicapped. It just wasn't a word that we used. And I thought that was pretty incredible, pretty inspiring story.
And a whole bunch of lessons. Good lessons.
Oh, yes. Yes. What a message for all of us, young and old, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just set your mind to it and don't. And when I spoke to her the first time, I said, Jen, when I write this story, I want to write about all the things you have, not the things that you don't have. That's not what I want to focus on. And that's the way I wrote the story.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I imagine there's some things she doesn't have, but it seems like that's, into her life, that's incidental. That's not the what's important. Contrary to what some people get into think, that feel sorry, or I'm a victim, or I can't because of whatever.
Right.
Okay, there's another inspiring story that you wrote about. It's called God Made a Mistake, and that sounds intriguing. Tell us the story behind that. God Made a Mistake.
Okay. This was an 18-year-old girl who wrote this story. And actually, I found out later, it was her college essay. And it was really a great essay. I bet she got in wherever she wanted to go with that essay. The story was that at exactly 6 months old, the day of her 6-month birthday, she arrived with her new parents from Guatemala, adopted into this family in the United States. And a wonderful family. Again, how family can make such a difference, Lon, because she just grew up in such a loving, nurturing home. By the way, I found out the mother was pregnant by the time they went down to Guatemala to get this baby, and the next year pregnant again after thinking she wasn't going to have any children. So God.
I heard that often happens.
Yeah, God works in mysterious ways, right? Mm-hmm. So every year, aside from her birthday, they would celebrate her six-month birthday, which was what they called Gotcha Day. And Gotcha Day was, again, a day with presents and, you know, just like a birthday, but it was a celebration of the day they got her and brought her to to the United States. And it was kind of like a big celebration. So,
you know, one of the mm-hmm. thoughts I had on this, I want to get back to a little bit more on this story because it sounds inspiring.
Sure.
But one of the thoughts is that one of the things that I've run into and had some clients that have severe attachment problems or reactive attachment disorder, RAD, RAD, is what it's called. And these very often are abandoned orphan children that were neglected for the first 6 months, few months, year, what have you, in an orphanage, either in Latin America or in, you know, Romania, Russia. And there's a fairly high percentage of kids with RAD that are adopted. And it sounds like somehow or others these two stories, children, managed to avoid that and turned out pretty positive.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
They were adopted into good parents, but the damage was so great they couldn't overcome it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there must have been some residual, I don't know if it was abandonment so much, but as I go on with the story, you'll understand. The last year that they celebrated Gotcha Day, she was pretty big by then. Her aunt and uncle were there, and they were planning to go to Nicaragua on a home rebuilding project with their two daughters, and they invited this little girl, this 18-year-old, to come with them. And she said she shouted out no vehemently. And she said, I couldn't understand why I reacted that way, because she said, it was cute. She said, I'm really a very nice person and I usually like to help people. So I don't know why I react. I didn't know why I reacted that way. And then she started to cry. And when everybody left, her mom and dad sat her down and they tried to talk to her about it. And she couldn't express what was bothering her. So her mom said, why don't you try to just write it out? Write out whatever thoughts are coming to you, and maybe that will help you. So she said, I didn't think that was going to help, but I did it anyway. And mm-hmm. she said, what I came to realize was that I was thinking Nicaragua was a country very much like Guatemala, where there was a lot of poverty, and I didn't want to see what, with my own eyes, what my life could have been like. Mm. So I thought that was pretty perceptive, you know, that she came to that realization. And the bottom line is she finally decided, after realizing what was troubling her so, she called her aunt and uncle and said, I decided I'd like to go with you. So they all went down there. And she showed me pictures. She sent me pictures via the internet that if you could have seen the house they lived in and what they considered a mansion, I mean, it was still, you know, a one room with a little dugout area as a shower, where they'd have to go up to the top of the hill to get to fill their buckets with water. But to them, it was a mansion by the time it was finished. But what this little girl wrote to me was that suddenly, during that whole week, she played with the children every day, the children who lived in that home. She said they had nothing more than a deflated soccer ball that they used to kick around. They'd collect shells on the beach and pebbles, and they made games. But she said there was so much love. The parents were very loving, and the children were so happy. And she began to realize that, you know, if I had stayed in Guatemala, if I had never been adopted, I could have had a happy life there, too. She said, I never would have known about smartphones and pretty clothes and the things that I have, so I wouldn't have felt badly that I didn't have them. So I thought that was a pretty good story.
Sounds like a very insightful young lady.
Yes, I would agree. And I think
how old is she now?
She's now, well, this was written a year ago, so she must be 19 now. She was 18 mm-hmm. when she wrote it. Mm-hmm.
Is she going to college?
Yes, she is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is. She's going to college. And this one, you know, I think I told you I have different books and they're named after gems. This one is the Topaz Collection, and that one is Stories of Awakenings and Aha Moments. And I think that fits very well because she had a real aha moment there.
Right, and she did it herself.
She did it herself.
You know, insight, that's hard to do. It's hard to be honest with ourselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she had to be in order to...
Yeah. But, Lon, I think also the kind of parent you have makes a difference. And the way they mm-hmm. talk to their children and open up to them and encourage this kind of thing. Not every parent is going to say, well, why don't you sit down and maybe if you're by yourself and you sit down and write some of your thoughts, maybe you'll have a better understanding of what you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And also to encourage a child to feel, and that feelings are okay, you know, to express them.
What would the lessons that you would take away from this story?
Well, I think they're good lessons for parents to begin with in the way you speak to your child and encourage them, and especially an adopted child, because that's where the title came from, because when she was very little, and she watched her mommy every year being pregnant again and pregnant again and her aunt being pregnant, you know, and she saw all these babies coming into the world. And she was told right away that she came a different way, that she came from Guatemala. So she kept asking, but whose tummy did I grow in? Whose tummy did I grow in, mommy? And it bothered her so much. She even went to her grandmother and asked, did I grow in your tummy, grandma? So so you see, that was bothering her. She wanted that place. And her mother finally said to her, Jessica, God made a mistake. You were supposed to be with us. And at first, when she told me that, I thought, ooh, is that a good thing to tell a child? But it worked for her. She felt all the more reason that this was her family. These were the mm-hmm. people that she was meant to be with.
Has she ever got in touch with her birth family, or does she want to, or is that sort of behind her?
First off, I don't believe the family had any history on the birth mother, the biological mother. So I would have to say no.
Okay, and so probably no chance of that.
Right.
Or very little. Mm. Okay. Well, geez, these are great, great stories.
They are wonderful stories.
the next one.
I have to fall in love with each one, Lon. I know,
and we could probably talk the whole hour on all of them. But let's go on to the next one. That sounds like...
Sure.
A very dramatic one. It comes from the Topaz Collections, just like the previous one has. It's As I Am, of Garrett Frey.
Oh,
the story of Garrett Frey.
That is, yes. This was quite a story. As I Am is the story of a little boy who he was still preschool at this time, and his parents both worked. And he would be with a babysitter. And the father picked him up one day after his work. And as a special treat, he picked him up on his motorcycle. And it happened to be a windy day, so he went back in to the babysitter because he had forgotten the little boy's scarf. And he carefully wrapped the scarf around the little boy's neck, put him back on the motorcycle, and oh, this little boy was just thrilled. The wind blew the scarf loose. It ended up in the back wheel of the motorcycle, and he was pulled off, rendered quadriplegic in a moment. The story starts, and the one who wrote the story is the psychologist.
Hey, you're fading a little bit. Could you speak up, please?
Is that better, Lon?
Yeah, as you get more emotional about these, you get softer and softer. Yeah,
and you know what
happens?
We have to
keep the volume up. Go ahead.
I dropped the phone. I think that's what happens. So I have to make sure that I keep it near my face. Did you hear that part, or should I go back?
No, I heard it, but I was starting to have to strain, and that's why I said something. Go ahead. Just continue your story.
Okay. So this psychologist was called in because she was known to be very good with children. I bet she was good with everybody, but she was called in. This happened in Iowa, by the way. And she said it was Christmas Eve. That's how she started her story. And she walked in, and she said it was the last place that she wanted to be on Christmas Eve, because she walked in, and here's this little boy with all kinds of ventilators and machinery around him. And she must have dropped her eyes to the floor.
Excuse me for interrupting. How old was he when this happened?
He was, I think, about six years old.
And, so this had been about seven.
And he caught it right away. And he said, "Why are you looking at the floor?" And she introduced herself, and she said, "Garrett, doctor, whatever the pediatrician's name was, asked me to come and see you." She said, "I don't know what we can do together, but I want to see if I can help." And his answer was, "I have a terrible tummy ache." Well, she said that was her first clue, because she didn't know how she was going to deal with this child. But when he said tummy ache, that was her first clue, because she said as a quadriplegic, she knew he couldn't feel sensation there. So she said, "Garrett, if you could be any place at all right now, where would you like to be?" And he said, "At the beach, in the water." And she said, "All right, let's do this." And she had him close his eyes and do a visualization. And he'd feel the warm water, he'd feel the sand under his feet. And when they had finished this little expedition, he looked up at her and he said, "How did you do that? My tummy ache is all gone." And she said, "Garrett, I didn't do it. You did it. I just gave you the tools to do it." Mm-hmm. And that started a 7-year relationship between the two of them. Then, Lon, this is an awfully sad part of the story. I mean, it wasn't always happy and uphill. It was sometimes pretty disastrous. And on one dark, gloomy day, she watched, without saying anything, as this little boy took his mouth, loosened the ribbon attached to the ventilator, and she knew what he was doing, and he knew what he was doing, too. And she just stared at him, and he stared back. And with that, the nurse came in, not noticing what had happened, but he was starting to cough. And the nurse turned him on his back to tap him. And the psychologist said, "Uh-oh, I think Garrett's ribbon is coming loose." So that was the clue. The nurse reattached it. When she left, the psychologist looked at him and said, "Well, Garrett, now that you know that you have more power than you thought you had, what do you plan to do with it?" And his answer was, "I don't remember the day I was born. I don't remember the day I died. I only remember me now as I am." And that's why she titled it, "As I Am." And then he said, "I promise I'll never do it again."
Okay, wow. So how old is he now? That was several years ago, I presume.
Yes, it is. He's a young adult now. Dr. Pernod, the psychologist, has since moved to Florida, to the Gulf Coast of Florida, and he actually came in a car with some of his friends down to visit. They've remained close. Actually, that was not his first trip. His first trip, they had arranged a book tour for him, and he came down. Every penny from that book tour and from sales of that book go to Garrett. That's how wonderful this psychologist is. I didn't know her then. She's become a good friend of mine since. But at the time, I didn't know her. I just admired her so much. He went to some of the schools where he presented at the schools and got standing ovations. So these are, you know, there's some good things that come. She had arranged with her husband to take Garrett out on a boat. And I believe the mother came then, too. And they took him, and that took a lot of doing because, I mean, there was a wheelchair that had to be secured to the boat floor first. And he just wanted to feel that wind and that salt air on his face, and he did. And he just said he would have loved to have lived down there, but he can't, you know. So he has made the most of his life, even though it's certainly there are limits to his life.
Well, I think one of the lessons that all of us can take is that nothing is really limiting that, you know, some people get into that. But that, again, like the previous stories, you can overcome real disadvantages and tragedies. You can overcome it with determination and confidence. So, again, I imagine a lot of the credit goes to the parents. The parents raising him that way and loving him and supporting him. Did you talk any on that part of it, the parents?
Sure. Well, the mother, I have to give the credit to the mother. The father did not remain with the family. I think it was just too much for him emotionally, and he backed away. But the mother has been a phenomenal support system. She fought all the way up to the Supreme Court to get him a public school education. He's a very bright young man, and she wanted him to have that socialization, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And
he was mainstreamed.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm.
And, well, keep talking. How did it work out?
And it worked out. It worked out very well, yes.
So he's graduated from high school. Is he doing anything on college?
Yes,
Kenny?
Mm-hmm. I don't believe so.
Okay, so what's his...
Could he? He probably could. I don't know. I shouldn't say yes or no, Lon, because I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, well, the curiosity and natural tendency will bring it up cycle. What's he doing now? What is his passions? Mm-hmm. What's he trying to do? Do you have any idea, or did the story break off before?
The story broke off before that. I do know, and this is because Dr. Pernod sent me a picture of Garrett and his mother and Christopher Reeves. So I do know that he had the opportunity to meet with him.
Oh, great. Well, they had something very similar.
Sure they did. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, gee, we're going to run out of time before we run out of stories. Legacy Lost is one. That was a German-Jewish boy and... the Holocaust and reaction to it. Tell us about this one.
Okay. This author came to the United States as a little boy, and he said he...
Oh, what year was that?
It had to be... let me just see now. That would be in the late 40s.
Late 40s. This was after the war was over.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So he had survived through the war and all that was going on. Was he in Germany or where?
He was, but he I don't know how he escaped the camps. I really don't know that part of the story, but I do know his mother escaped it by she was assigned to a warehouse as a young girl. And it was her job to go through piles and piles of clothes and look in the pockets and look in the seams and find any little trinkets or treasures that were hidden there. She had no idea at the time why she was being asked to do this. These were the people who had already been had been exterminated. Those were the discarded clothing.
Be sure to speak up.
Okay. Better.
Thank you. Yeah, you have a tendency, just natural tendency to get soft as you get into emotionally laden stuff. And then they've had a little trouble hearing you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So she was collecting all these trinkets, and she just knew it was her job. She didn't know where this clothing came from. When they came to the United States, he was a little boy, he said his mother didn't talk about and not, his father didn't talk about what had happened there, but the hushed tones that they'd hear when the parents spoke in Polish made him know it was something horrible. So he was afraid to ask, and instead
so
of
So all
asking,
three of them managed to escape the concentration camps.
Yes, missing. They did. Yes. He created all, he was a very imaginative little child, and he created all these imaginary monsters, and they, you know, and then as he got a little bit older, when he started to write, he wrote stories about the monsters, and still he didn't ask what the real story was. As a mature adult, he was a teacher, by the way, and also a writer, a published writer. And one day there was he found out about a contest, and it was like a last minute thing, a short story, and he wrote the story about the warehouse. He called it The Warehouse, and he used the facts that he did know, which were very few, about his mother, you know, gathering these treasures from the clothing, and then he invented the rest of it. And it won a prize. And with the prize came this critique of it that said, a haunting work of fiction. And that bothered him so much. Why did I write it as fiction? Why didn't I ever ask my mother? Not only that, his mother had been interviewed for the Spielberg's Shoah project, and she had sent him the tape, and he put it away. He never watched it. So he kind of buried all that.
Mm-hmm.
So after that review, when it said a haunting work of fiction, he said, I've got to set things right. This wasn't right that I wrote it as fiction. It should have been a true story. And he was planning to go down to Florida, where his mother was, to talk to her and interview her. And he said, I'll tell her what I did. She'll understand. Unfortunately, by the time he got there, he had also received a phone call from the dad that his mom was in the hospital. He got to her bedside, and she was no longer with them. She couldn't speak. She was all wired up, and she closed her eyes and passed while he was sitting there. And it bothered him so that he never got that legacy from her. And that's why he named it Legacy Lost. And he said he has, when he lectures and when he talks to children and adults, he's always talking to them about their legacy, and to ask questions, write it down so you'll have the stories. Otherwise, they'll be lost. Don't do what I did, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, what lessons do you take from that? What was your reaction?
Well, I agree with him, Lon. I know that years ago I had been at a conference where they were proposing that you, or advocating, I should say, that we tape record our parents and family members that are close to us. And I did that. And I did that with both of my parents and an uncle that I'm very close to. And those are treasured pieces of my collection, because I hear their voices, not just a written dialogue, but I hear their voices. And that's something special for me that I took away from this. So I totally agree.
Yeah, and it's something all of us, I know I have from with my family, there's stories that have passed down, but it wasn't systematic, a little piece here, a little anecdote there. Mm-hmm. Going back to the Civil War, I had two great-great uncles that died at Gettysburg, and but that's about all that I've heard.
Yes.
Not too much more about them, and so, I guess every family loses some of the legacy over a few generations. Mm-hmm. I know nothing before Ohio. My family came from Massachusetts to Ohio to Nebraska to Idaho, and very, very little about Ohio, and some a little bit about Nebraska, and that's, three generations back, and I don't know anything about Massachusetts, family in Massachusetts, and that's some of the legacy lost, and not what you're talking about. That would be good. That would be good to...
You
have
know, the
some
pity is, I'm sorry, Lon.
Go ahead.
It would be good. The pity is, I think, with most young people, I know I was like that, I really wasn't that interested. It was only as I got older that I became so interested in this. And I think that may be very typical of young people. And then later on you say, why didn't I ask more questions? I'd love to know about this. I'd love to know about that. But, you know, I didn't ask at the time.
Yeah, I remember when I wanted to have stories, I'd go with my mom and dad and get them when I was a kid. But they've passed on, and there's a lot of things I don't really remember or I never ask. We do have a comment on our chat line, so... So do people of all ages, young and old, submit their stories to you? How do they get picked to be into your books? And is there a limit to a certain number of pages per story or other criteria they need to meet? You want to talk about that? How many stories do you generally go through to pick out the winners? Those are all sort of a series of questions, all related.
Wow.
So I guess we have about 5 minutes. So why don't you talk about the project and a little bit of what you do and answer this question?
Okay. The first thing I would say, because it's all up on the website, and it would be so easy to go to that website. It's www.tales, spelled T-A-L-E-S, not the animal tales, inspire.com. Very simple, tales2inspire.com. And it was professionally designed, so it's easy to navigate, and all the information is up there. But very quickly, the criteria... maximum 1,200 words. I ask that they submit a couple of pictures, and one of the reasons I do that is I want to be able to authenticate that it's a true story. How many I receive, it could be 40, it could be 20, it depends, you know, it just depends on the time of year maybe or whatever. I am just completing this one contest now, so I don't have a date yet for the next one, but it will be posted on the website. Each book takes a lot of work to get it in order. How are they picked? And this is a very interesting thing, and this is, again, the teacher in me. Every story that is accepted, I don't accept them all, and I'll write back and I'll tell them why, but every story that's accepted into this contest, that author is responsible for judging three other stories and writing a short critique. I base it on the scores. That's how I choose. If there's discrepancy, then I go to my writers group and I have other people that I can depend on to evaluate and give their input. So I step back. And by the way, it's all done anonymously, and the stories I write are subjected to the same criteria. Nobody knows they're judging my stories. And believe me, there are times when I find out, you know, I get a good pointer here and there from somebody else. So that's basically the way it works.
Okay. They have one question here, and maybe give an idea that how many stories do you generally go through to pick out the winners? And so maybe a comparison, how many stories might come in and how many would be picked?
Okay. As I said, the books generally have about 12 to 14 stories in them. There might be, and it depends because it varies. How many do I get? It depends. It could be as few as 20. It could be as many as 40. It just depends. So I can't give an exact number there. But I do know that sometimes there's a winning story. For instance, there's one called A Leap of Words. This gal's been waiting for 2 years to get her story published. It was a winner back then, but I didn't have the right collection for it. Now with the Ruby collection, which is Gifts of Compassion, it fits.
Okay, so each book has a theme.
Each book has a theme. So the sapphire is echoes in the mind, and I told you about the topaz. The emerald is beyond coincidence stories. So those are done, and the topaz I told you about, right? And the ruby is gifts of compassion.
So okay, and that's the one you're working on now.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so is this pretty much has this become sort of a full-time activity on your part or things related?
Or ask my husband. He'll say, how can you spend so much time there on that computer? And I have some very uplifting ones too, Lon. I don't want people to think they all have to be heavy duty. There's just some delightful ones. This gal wrote, "Don't worry, okay. Mom." About
well, we have about less than 1 minute left, so I think we have to hang off. And again, on the chat line, somebody thanks you for promoting these new aspiring authors. I presume some of them are aspiring authors, and some of them are, I presume, just telling their story. But this has been delightful, and I still had another three or four stories to talk about. Ran out of time, but thank you very much. I've been this is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report. Been talking with Lois Stern and Tales to Inspire. Replenishing your soul, and yes, just talking about it for this hour, I can see how that could give you faith in the power of the human spirit to overcome adversity and develop. And some of the other stories, look at some other facets with it. Be sure to come back next week on K4HD.com and the Woodbury Report. And this is Lon Woodbury. Thank you very much, Lois. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Lon. We'll